Lionhead Studios are memorable developers for several reasons. Founded as an offshoot from Peter Molyneux's celebrated Bullfrog Productions, Lionhead was originally intended to be creatively liberating. EA had acquired Bullfrog in 1995, which Molyneux considered increasingly difficult to work with, so his next venture felt promising and exciting. But, over 19 years of operation, only 8 of their games saw public release, and 5 of those belonged to the Fable series. Despite talented staff, great concepts, and true creative flair, Lionhead were marred by financial difficulties. That led to their eventual buyout by Microsoft in 2006, and the critical reception of Fable, their main property, began to wane. They shut up shop 10 years later after experimenting with free-to-play models, leaving behind one of gaming's most interesting legacies. In the beginning, their potential was formidable. It seemed to recapture the magic that fueled so many classic Bullfrog titles, like Dungeon Keeper and Populous. Along with a driven team, Molyneux set gleefully to work on their first release, Black and White, which followed many of the traditions laid out by his previous God games. The presence of Russell Shaw as Lionhead's official head of music only added to that somewhat nostalgic quality, since he was key to the sound of Bullfrog Productions through the 90s. So, waves of celebration rippled through PC gamers' bedrooms when Black and White shipped in 2001. It would be an understatement to say that it was a critical darling of its time. Universally, it was considered a must-have game for its visuals, imaginative gameplay, and the integration of a creature that dynamically responds to your actions. I'm Lee Tyrrell, and this is The Sound Test, where I look in-depth into video game audio and music, along with the very people who crafted it. For this episode, I spoke to the multi-talented Russell Shaw about Black and White, a release that occupies an interesting space in both his career and VGM in general. This is the second part of a Lionhead double bill, and a far shorter bonus episode in the overall series. The main episode of this two-parter, which examines the sound of the whole Fable series, again with Russell, is also available wherever you might be listening to this. At the helm of Fable's audio, Russell commanded full physical orchestras. Before that, when working for Bullfrog, his output was almost exclusively synthesized for sound cards and chips. Black and White came somewhere in the middle of that transition, sitting comfortably in an established era of CD audio. The limited waveforms and samples that dominated VGM beforehand were suddenly antiquated, but most composers like Russell were left without resources like orchestras until more ambitious projects. Importantly, music was quickly gaining the respect it always deserved from developers. Rather than an afterthought, Game soundtracks and their creators became more essential to the process. So how did such changes affect veterans like Russell?
By that time, I was in on the conceptual stage, which, you know, I'm there at the very, very beginning working with the game designers, you know, working out part of the game design, how, you know, how the whole game is going to fit together. And to be involved with that, it lends itself to making a better soundtrack at the end of the day, I think, and a better sound design, because, you know, the bolt-on sort of aspect of audio from the past, where you were just the sound guy at the end of the project, that doesn't really lend itself to doing cool things with audio, because A, it's rushed, and B, you know, much of the game design is done, so you can't really influence anything from an audio point of view. And so I found that the earlier I was working on a game, the more I inspired the game designers to do stuff which would work in tandem with some of the ideas I had with audio. That really sort of made the games we were working on quite unique and sound quite different to what everyone else was doing at the time.
Though there are some notable exceptions, game soundtracks of the early and mid-90s were usually overlaid in the final stage of production. There wasn't as much crossover between gameplay and audio as there is today, but that had started to change by the 21st century. Released in 2001, Black and White was among Russell's first games to integrate sound into the experience more profoundly. In essence, the game casts you as a largely unseen deity, where you're given free rein with good and evil actions to influence the world's inhabitants. Besides your creature, who generally acts as your physical representation, your only in-game avatar is the pointing finger of a mouse. It's used for just about everything, including hurling your worshippers around, navigating the map, and drawing symbols that cause a variety of results. Thanks to the evolution of game audio, even moving the mouse in certain ways could come across through your speakers.
In Black and White, we had a whole gesture system where you could actually draw with your mouse an action that you wanted to do. So, for instance, if you wanted one of the creatures to fall in love with you, you could draw a heart around it in the game with your mouse. And the game recognized that you'd drawn a heart, and it then sort of pinged, you know, it sort of pinged the shape that you'd drawn and made it into a proper full-blown graphic of a heart. I'm not sure if that one actually made it into the game in the end, but it's like an example of the sort of things that we were trying to do. To do a whirlwind, for instance, you just draw a spiral with your mouse. And like I say, this gesture-based system was something that I thought, I can really make this cool with audio, because I can change the velocity of the sound that I'm making based on how fast you're moving the mouse. And then when the game has recognized the fact that you've drawn this symbol, I can make the audio ping out so that you get the idea of the fact that you've solidified this shape and it's come out. That was one example of how I knew that from the game design, how I would implement the sound for that, sort of even before it had gone into the game.
Adaptive elements are a big part of Black and White's actual music too, which leans heavily into hypnotic synthscapes. Gameplay is usually scored by soft electronic movements, with cultural embellishments added on top, depending on any tribe you might be hovering over. There are several throughout the campaign, such as Egyptian, Indian, Greek, and Celtic. Whenever you're in close proximity, each of the tribes will trigger their own unique sound. Although sometimes processed, the exotic instrumental sounds that accompany different tribes are the very real playing of Stefan Hannigan, a multi-instrumentalist with a flair for improvisation. It's a satisfying feature, and a seemingly natural extension of elements Russell included in games like Theme Park. So how did it build on earlier experiments with interactive mixing?
I wanted the background music to be very ambient, but I also wanted it to represent each of the tribes that we were currently looking at in the game. There were eight tribes, ranging from Japanese to Aztec to what other ones were there? There was a Celtic tribe. There are all these different styles. And I thought, what I'd like to do is actually have one single background track, but then over the top, interlay all the different tribal music. So I found a guy called Stefan Hannigan, who actually was one of the guys who worked on the original Braveheart movie, who said that he could do all of it for me. He could record all the instrumentation from all the different tribes. I sent him over a drone track, which he then just, I told him to just, you know, improvise over the top, ad lib as many different sort of riffs and motifs as he could, based on the, you know, the motifs that I'd sent him. And he sent all those back, and then I compiled about 24 music tracks, good, evil, and neutral, for each of the tribes. But the background track for each of those was identical. It was just the instrumentation over the top that changed. What I did in game was because I was a coder back then as well, I coded a system where I could change the music from one of the tracks to another seamlessly without you noticing that the background track had changed. As you hovered over the landscape and you moved into a different region, I would swap to a different tribal piece, or as you were hovering over the same region but your alignment changed, I was able to change it to a more evil style or a neutral style or whatever. Yeah, it sounded great in the end. I was really pleased with how that worked.
Three main pieces, each tied to your alignment, create the predominant sound of Black and White. But they're joined on the OST by multiple shorter tracks, meant for specific events and characters. Altogether, they form a surprisingly colourful whole, pushing the hyper-real setting of the game to the forefront of players' minds. It's tough to describe Russell's soundtrack briefly, as it carefully juggles so many different styles, all smoothly connected by rich synthesizers underneath.
There's so many aspects to the game, you know, like you say, there's and it's really weird and an offset type of world where you don't quite know what's going on, you know, with huge creatures walking around and one minute you're looking at a hermit living up in the mountains in a shack, next minute you're looking at some sort of ogre asking you to do stuff. You've got you've got your good and your evil conscience sort of pinged onto the screen every now and again. So it wasn't a game where I thought we could have one music style for this game. It was just a no-brainer, really, to make it as diverse as possible and have as many musical styles in there as I possibly could. So, like, you've got the pirate song, the missionary song, rather, who are building the ark. You've got, like you say, there's almost like Rykuda-style electric guitar for the hermit. You've got this heavy, distorted electric guitar for Slegg. You've got sort of a very ambient style, almost Ortega style music for some of the soundtrack, orchestral for other parts as well. So I wanted it to sound as varied as possible.
The shackles of chips like the Adlib, which used rudimentary waves and simple FM synthesis, were long gone by Black and White. That opened the door to compositional laziness and rampant innovation alike, with driven composers like Russell on one clear side of that divide. The varied sound of Black and White is one example of that, effortlessly shifting from ghostly, distant pipes to pounding rhythms and on through a continuing list of different palettes. With that many genres and feelings on the table, what did Russell use to produce it all?
By that time, I was using a whole range of synths in the studio because Black and White was pure synth work. There was no real orchestra on that track at all. On one of the tracks, it needed this sort of weird pipe sound. I had a didgeridoo sample CD, which had only just come out, actually. And I didn't want it to sound like a didgeridoo as such. I wanted it to sound a bit more futuristic than that. Took a few of the samples of the didgeridoo and I put them into one of the synths I had. I'm not sure which one it was now. I think it might have been a Waldorf Wave or something like that. I put the sound in and I mixed it in with the sound of real pipes, and the sound that we got out of it, or the sound that I got out of it, was amazing. It sounded really, really cool.
The enormous success of Black and White was a fantastic start for Lionhead, giving them all the momentum they needed to leap straight into the Fable series, which made up the rest of their output except the movies, a sim based around directing films, with an inventive soundtrack by Daniel Pemberton, recent composer of Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, and also known for extensive work on Little Big Planet. Black and White itself got a sequel in 2005, but its music was handled by Craig Beattie, who usually takes roles in sound design. Again, Black and White 2 has a varied feel, full of different styles, gorgeous vocals, and crisp production. But Fable took over Lionhead as their predominant focus, and we wouldn't see another God game from Molyneux until 2014's Godos, a 22 cans release. By the end, exploring new territory with the online-focused Fable Legends led to Lionhead's demise, who then split its staff between several fresh developers. In his role as the company's head of music, Russell was given the perfect projects to advance his already formidable skills. Fable obviously opened the door to orchestras and choirs, but Black and White is a career milestone for summing up all his growth as a producer and composer up to that point. Along with honed ambient synthesis, Russell experimented with instrumental textures and used both to create a cleverly adaptive web of sound. Come 2001, game composers were no longer a necessary afterthought. They became integral to the process from a title's first conception, and thankfully, it's a trend that continues today.
Black and White, as you say, I was sitting in the very, very early design meetings and coming up with ideas for the game design that I knew I'd be able to do cool audio things with. And if I hadn't have been there at that time, you know, A, those ideas might never have made it into the game, and B, they may have sounded completely different.
Thanks to Russell for speaking to me for this bonus episode of The Sound Test, but thank you too for taking the time to listen. If you've enjoyed what you've heard, please make sure to subscribe or follow on whatever platform you're listening on. Don't forget that the first episode of this Lionhead double bill, concentrating on Fable, is also available now, providing much more insight on the studio's audio. Otherwise, there will be a new episode each week, with next week's launching into the nearly infinite universe of No Man's Sky. Along with veteran sound designer Paul Weir, I'll be joined by 65 Days of Static founding member Paul Walinski. Together, we'll be taking a look at the challenges that come with procedural music, and how they achieved a constantly dynamic blanket of sound. All my Patreon supporters gain early access to that edition, no matter how much they pledge. So head on over to patreon.com/_secretcave if you'd like to show your support and hear next week's episode right now. Of course, this doesn't apply if you're already a patron and hearing this episode in advance.
Hey, it's not finished!